Chapter 10. Enter Sir James Peel Egerton. Tuppence betrayed no awkwardness in her new duties. The daughters of the Archdeacon were well grounded in household tasks. They were also experts in training a raw girl, the inevitable result being that the raw girl, once trained, departed elsewhere, where her newly acquired knowledge commanded a more substantial remuneration than the Archdeacon's meagre purse allowed. Tuppence had therefore very little fear of proving inefficient. Mrs. Vandermeer's cook puzzled her. She evidently went in deadly terror of her mistress. The girl thought it probable that the other woman had some hold over her. For the rest, she cooked like a chef, as Tuppence had an opportunity of judging that evening. Mrs. Vandermeer was expecting a guest to dinner, and Tuppence accordingly laid the beautifully polished table for two. She was a little exercised in her own mind as to this visitor. It was highly possible that it might prove to be Whittington. Although she felt fairly confident that he would not recognize her, yet she would have been better pleased had the guest proved to be a total stranger. However, there was nothing for it but to hope for the best. At a few minutes past eight, the front door bell rang, and Tuppence went to answer it with some inward trepidation. She was relieved to see that the visitor was the second of the two men whom Tommy had taken upon himself to follow. He gave his name as Count Stepanov. Tuppence announced him, and Mrs. Vandermeer rose from her seat on a low divan with a quick murmur of pleasure. "It is delightful to see you, Boris Ivanovitch," she said. "And you, madame?" He bowed low over her hand. Tuppence returned to the kitchen. "Count Stepanov, or some such," she remarked, affecting a frank and unvarnished curiosity. "Who's he?" "A Russian gentleman, I believe." "Come here much?" "Once in a while, what do you want to know for?" "Fancied he might be sweet on the missus, that's all," explained the girl, adding with an appearance of sulkiness, "How you do take one up?" "I'm not quite easy in my mind about the souffle," explained the other.
"You know something," thought Tuppence to herself. But aloud she only said, "Going to dish up now? Righto!"
Whilst waiting at table, Tuppence listened closely to all that was said. She remembered that this was one of the men Tommy was shadowing when she had last seen him. Already, although she would hardly admit it, she was becoming uneasy about her partner. Where was he? Why had no word of any kind come from him? She had arranged, before leaving the Ritz, to have all letters or messages sent on at once by special messenger to a small stationer's shop near at hand, where Albert was to call in frequently. True, it was only yesterday morning that she had parted from Tommy, and she told herself that any anxiety on his behalf would be absurd. Still, it was strange that he had sent no word of any kind. But listen as she might, the conversation presented no clue. Boris and Mrs. Vandermeer talked on purely indifferent subjects, plays they had seen, new dances, and the latest society gossip. After dinner they repaired to the small boudoir, where Mrs. Vandermeer, stretched on the divan, looked more wickedly beautiful than ever. Tuppence brought in the coffee and liqueurs and unwillingly retired. As she did so, she heard Boris say, "New, isn't she?"
"She came in today. The other was a fiend. This girl seems all right. She waits well."
Tuppence lingered a moment longer by the door, which she had carefully neglected to close, and heard him say,
"Quite safe, I suppose."
"Really, Boris, you are absurdly suspicious. I believe she's the cousin of the hall porter or something of the kind, and nobody even dreams that I have any connection with our mutual friend, Mr. Brown."
"For heaven's sake, be careful, Rita, that door isn't shut."
"Well, shut it, then," laughed the woman.
Tuppence removed herself speedily. She dared not absent herself longer from the back premises, but she cleared away and washed up with a breathless speed acquired in hospital. Then she slipped quietly back to the boudoir door. The cook, more leisurely, was still busy in the kitchen, and if she missed the other, would only suppose her to be turning down the beds. Alas, the conversation inside was being carried on in too low a tone to permit of her hearing anything of it. She dared not reopen the door, however gently. Mrs. Vandermeer was sitting almost facing it, and Tuppence respected her mistress's lynx-eyed powers of observation. Nevertheless, she felt she would give a good deal to overhear what was going on. Possibly, if anything unforeseen had happened, she might get news of Tommy. For some moments she reflected desperately. Then her face brightened. She went quickly along the passage to Mrs. Vandermeer's bedroom, which had long French windows leading onto a balcony that ran the length of the flat. Slipping quickly through the window, Tuppence crept noiselessly along till she reached the boudoir window. As she had thought, it stood a little ajar, and the voices within were plainly audible. Tuppence listened attentively, but there was no mention of anything that could be twisted to apply to Tommy. Mrs. Vandermeer and the Russian seemed to be at variance over some matter, and finally the latter exclaimed bitterly, "With your persistent recklessness you will end by ruining us."
"Ah," laughed the woman, "notoriety of the right kind is the best way of disarming suspicion. You will realize that one of these days, perhaps sooner than you think."
"In the meantime you are going about everywhere with P. Ledgerton. Not only is he perhaps the most celebrated K.C. in England, but his special hobby is criminology. It is madness."
"I know that his eloquence has saved untold men from the gallows," said Mrs. Vandermeer calmly. "What of it? I may need his assistance in that line myself some day. If so, how fortunate to have such a friend at court. Or perhaps it would be more to the point to say, in court."
Boris got up and began striding up and down. He was very excited.
"You're a clever woman, Rita, but you're also a fool. Be guided by me and give up, P. Ledgerton."
Mrs. Vandermeer shook her head gently.
"I think not."
"You refuse?"
There was an ugly ring in the Russian's voice.
"I do."
"Then, by heaven," snarled the Russian, "we will see—"
But Mrs. Vandermeer also rose to her feet, her eyes flashing.
"You forget, Boris," she said. "I am accountable to no one. I take my orders only from Mr. Brown."
The other threw up his hands in despair.
"You are impossible," he muttered. "Impossible. Already it may be too late. They say P. Ledgerton can smell a criminal. How do we know what is at the bottom of his sudden interest in you? Perhaps even now his suspicions are aroused. He guesses—"
Mrs. Vandermeer eyed him scornfully.
"Reassure yourself, my dear Boris. He suspects nothing. With less than your usual chivalry, you seem to forget that I am commonly accounted a beautiful woman. I assure you that is all that interests P. Ledgerton."
Boris shook his head doubtfully.
"He has studied crime as no other man in this kingdom has studied it. Do you fancy that you can deceive him?"
Mrs. Vandermeer's eyes narrowed.
"If he is all that you say, it would amuse me to try."
"Good heavens, Rita!"
"Besides," added Mrs. Vandermeer, "he is extremely rich. I am not one who despises money. The sinews of war, you know, Boris."
"Money, money! That is always the danger with you, Rita. I believe you would sell your soul for money. I believe—"
He paused, then in a low, sinister voice he said slowly,
"Sometimes I believe that you would sell us."
Mrs. Vandermeer smiled and shrugged her shoulders.
"The price, at any rate, would have to be enormous," she said lightly. "It would be beyond the power of anyone but a millionaire to pay."
"Ah!" snarled the Russian. "You see, I was right."
"My dear Boris, can you not take a joke?"
"Was it a joke?"
"Of course."
"Then all I can say is that your ideas of humour are peculiar, my dear Rita."
Mrs. Vandermeer smiled.
"Let us not quarrel, Boris. Touch the bell. We will have some drinks."
Tuppence beat a hasty retreat. She paused a moment to survey herself in Mrs. Vandermeer's long glass and be sure that nothing was amiss with her appearance. Then she answered the bell demurely. The conversation that she had overheard, although interesting in that it proved beyond doubt the complicity of both Rita and Boris, threw very little light on the present preoccupations. The name of Jane Finn had not even been mentioned. The following morning, a few brief words with Albert informed her that nothing was waiting for her at the stationer's. It seemed incredible that Tommy, if all was well with him, should not send any word to her. A cold hand seemed to close round her heart. Supposing— She choked her fears down bravely. It was no good worrying. But she leapt at a chance offered her by Mrs. Vandermeer.
"What day do you usually go out, Prudence?"
"Friday's my usual day, ma'am." Mrs. Vandermeer lifted her eyebrows. "And today is Friday. But I suppose you hardly wish to go out today, as you only came yesterday."
"I was thinking of asking you if I might, ma'am."
Mrs. Vandermeer looked at her a minute longer and then smiled.
"I wish Count Stepanov could hear you. He made a suggestion about you last night."
Her smile broadened, cat-like.
"Your request is very typical. I'm satisfied. You do not understand all this, but you can go out today. It makes no difference to me, as I shall not be dining at home."
"Thank you, ma'am." Tuppence felt a sensation of relief once she was out of the other's presence. Once again she admitted to herself that she was afraid, horribly afraid, of the beautiful woman with the cruel eyes. In the midst of a final desultory polishing of her silver, Tuppence was disturbed by the ringing of the front doorbell and went to answer it. This time the visitor was neither Whittington nor Boris, but a man of striking appearance. Just a shade over average height, he nevertheless conveyed the impression of a big man. His face, clean-shaven and exquisitely mobile, was stamped with an expression of power and force far beyond the ordinary. Magnetism seemed to radiate from him. Tuppence was undecided for the moment whether to put him down as an actor or a lawyer, but her doubts were soon solved as he gave her his name, Sir James Peel Egerton. She looked at him with renewed interest. This, then, was the famous K.C. whose name was familiar all over England. She had heard it said that he might one day be Prime Minister. He was known to have refused office in the interest of his profession, preferring to remain a simple member for a Scotch constituency. Tuppence went back to her pantry thoughtfully. The great man had impressed her. She understood Boris's agitation. Peel Egerton would not be an easy man to deceive. In about a quarter of an hour the bell rang, and Tuppence repaired to the hall to show the visitor out. He had given her a piercing glance before. Now, as she handed him his hat and stick, she was conscious of his eyes raking her through. As she opened the door and stood aside to let him pass out, he stopped in the doorway.
"Not been doing this long, eh?"
Tuppence raised her eyes, astonished. She read in his glance kindliness and something else more difficult to fathom. He nodded as though she had answered.
"V.A.D. and hard up, I suppose."
"Did Mrs. Vandermeer tell you that?" asked Tuppence suspiciously.
"No, child. The look of you told me. Good place here?"
"Very good, thank you, sir."
"Ah, but there are plenty of good places nowadays, and a change does no harm sometimes."
"Do you mean—" began Tuppence. But Sir James was already on the topmost stair.
He looked back with his kindly, shrewd glance.
"Just a hint," he said. "That's all."
Tuppence went back to the pantry, more thoughtful than ever. Chapter 11. Julius Tells a Story. Dressed appropriately, Tuppence duly sallied forth for her afternoon out. Albert was in temporary abeyance, but Tuppence went herself to the stationer's to make quite sure that nothing had come for her. Satisfied on this point, she made her way to the Ritz. On inquiry, she learned that Tommy had not yet returned. It was the answer she had expected, but it was another nail in the coffin of her hopes. She resolved to appeal to Mr. Carter, telling him when and where Tommy had started on his quest, and asking him to do something to trace him. The prospect of his aid revived her mercurial spirits, and she next inquired for Julius Hirschheimer. The reply she got was to the effect that he had returned about half an hour ago, but had gone out immediately. Tuppence's spirits revived still more. It would be something to see Julius. Perhaps he could devise some plan for finding out what had become of Tommy. She wrote her note to Mr. Carter in Julius's sitting room, and was just addressing the envelope when the door burst open.
"What the hell?"
began Julius, but checked himself abruptly.
"I beg your pardon, Miss Tuppence. Those fools down at the office would have it that Beresford wasn't here any longer. Hadn't been here since Wednesday, is that so?"
Tuppence nodded.
"'You don't know where he is?' she asked faintly.
"'Aye, how should I know? I haven't had one darn word from him, although I wired him yesterday morning.'
"'I expect your wire's at the office unopened.'
"'But where is he?'
"'I don't know. I hoped you might.'
"'I tell you, I haven't had one darn word from him since we parted at the depot on Wednesday.'
"'What depot?'
"'Waterloo. Your London and Southwestern Road.'
"'Waterloo?' frowned Tuppence.
"'Why, yes, didn't he tell you?'
"'I haven't seen him either,' replied Tuppence impatiently. "'Go on about Waterloo. What were you doing there?'
"'He gave me a call over the phone. Told me to get a move on and hustle. Said he was trailing two crooks.'
"'Oh!' said Tuppence, her eyes opening. "'I see. Go on.'
"'I hurried along, right away. Beresford was there. He pointed out the crooks. The big one was mine, the guy you bluffed. Tommy shoved a ticket into my hand and told me to get aboard the cars. He was going to sleuth the other crook.'
Julius paused.
"'I thought for sure you'd know all this.'
"'Julius!' said Tuppence firmly. "'Stop walking up and down. It makes me giddy. Sit down in that armchair and tell me the whole story with as few fancy turns of speech as possible.' Mr. Hirschheimer obeyed.
"'Sure,' he said. "'Where shall I begin?'
"'Where you left off, at Waterloo.'
"'Well,' began Julius, "'I got into one of your dear old-fashioned first-class British compartments. The train was just off.' First thing I knew, a guard came along and informed me mighty politely that I wasn't in a smoking carriage. I handed him out half a dollar, and that settled that. I did a bit of prospecting along the corridor to the next coach. Whittington was there, right enough. When I saw the skunk with his big, sleek, fat face, and thought of poor little Jane in his clutches, I felt real mad that I hadn't got a gun with me. I'd have tickled him up some. We got to Bournemouth, all right. Whittington took a cab and gave the name of an hotel. I did likewise, and we drove up within 3 minutes of each other. He hired a room, and I hired one, too. So far it was all plain sailing. He hadn't the remotest notion that anyone was on to him. Well, he just sat around in the hotel lounge, reading the papers and so on, till it was time for dinner. He didn't hurry any over that, either. I began to think that there was nothing doing, that he'd just come on the trip for his health. But I remembered that he hadn't changed for dinner, though it was by way of being a slap-up hotel. So it seemed likely enough that he'd be going out on his real business afterwards. Sure enough, about 9 o'clock, so he did. Took a car across the town. Mighty pretty place, by the way. I guess I'll take Jane there for a spell when I find her. And then paid it off and struck out along those pine woods on the top of the cliff. I was there too, you understand. We walked, maybe for half an hour. There's a lot of villas all the way along, but by degrees they seem to get more and more thinned out. And in the end we got to one that seemed the last of the bunch. Big house it was, with a lot of piney grounds around it. It was a pretty black night, and the carriage drive up to the house was dark as pitch. I could hear him ahead, though I couldn't see him. I had to walk carefully, in case he might get on to it that he was being followed. I turned a curve, and I was just in time to see him ring the bell and get admitted to the house. I just stopped where I was. It was beginning to rain, and I was soon pretty near soaked through. Also, it was almighty cold. Whittington didn't come out again, and by and by I got kind of restive and began to mooch around. All the ground-floor windows were shuttered tight, but upstairs on the first floor, it was a two-storied house, I noticed a window with a light burning and the curtains not drawn. Now, just opposite to that window there was a tree growing. It was about 30 feet away from the house, maybe, and I sort of got it into my head that if I climbed up that tree I'd very likely be able to see into that room. Of course, I knew there was no reason why Whittington should be in that room rather than in any other. Less reason, in fact, for the betting would be on his being in one of the reception rooms downstairs. But I guess I'd got the hump from standing so long in the rain, and anything seemed better than going on doing nothing, so I started up. It wasn't so easy by a long chalk. The rain had made the boughs mighty slippery. It was all I could do to keep a foothold, but bit by bit I managed it, until at last there I was, level with the window. But then I was disappointed. I was too far to the left. I could only see sideways into the room. A bit of curtain and a yard of wallpaper was all I could command. Well, that wasn't any manner of good to me. But just as I was going to give it up and climb down ignominiously, someone inside moved and threw his shadow on my little bit of wall, and by gum it was Whittington, After that, my blood was up. I'd just got to get a look into that room. It was up to me to figure out how. I noticed that there was a long branch running out from the tree in the right direction. If I could only swarm about halfway along it, the proposition would be solved. But it was mighty uncertain whether it would bear my weight. I decided I'd just got to risk that, and I started. Very cautiously, inch by inch, I crawled along. The bough creaked and swayed in a nasty fashion, and it didn't do to think of the drop below, but at last I got safely to where I wanted to be. The room was medium-sized, furnished in a kind of bare, hygienic way. There was a table with a lamp on it in the middle of the room, and sitting at that table, facing towards me, was Whittington, right enough. He was talking to a woman dressed as a hospital nurse. She was sitting with her back to me, so I couldn't see her face. Although the blinds were up, the window itself was shut, so I couldn't catch a word of what they said. Whittington seemed to be doing all the talking, and the nurse just listened. Now and then she nodded, and sometimes she'd shake her head as though she were answering questions. He seemed very emphatic. Once or twice he beat with his fist on the table. The rain had stopped now, and the sky was clearing in that sudden way it does. Presently he seemed to get to the end of what he was saying. He got up, and so did she. He looked towards the window and asked something. I guess it was whether it was raining. Anyway, she came right across and looked out. Just then the moon came out from behind the clouds. I was scared the woman would catch sight of me, for I was full in the moonlight. I tried to move back a bit. The jerk I gave was too much for that rotten old branch. With an almighty crash, down it came, and Julius P. Hirschheimer with it.
"Oh, Julius," breathed Tuppence, "how exciting! Go on."
Well, luckily for me, I pitched down into a good soft bed of earth, but it put me out of action for the time, sure enough. Next thing I knew, I was lying in bed with a hospital nurse, not Whittington's one, on one side of me, and a little black-bearded man with gold glasses and medical man written all over him on the other. He rubbed his hands together and raised his eyebrows as I stared at him. "Ah," he said, "so our young friend is coming round again. Capital, capital." I did the usual stunt, said, "What's happened, and where am I?" I knew the answer to the last well enough. There's no moss growing on my brain. "I think that'll do for the present, sister," said the little man, and the nurse left the room in a sort of brisk, well-trained way. But I caught her hand in me out a look of deep curiosity as she passed through the door. That look of hers gave me an idea. "Now then, Doc," I said, and tried to sit up in bed, but my right foot gave me a nasty twinge as I did so. "A slight sprain," explained the doctor. "Nothing serious. You'll be about again in a couple of days."
"I noticed you walked lame," interpolated Tuppence.
Julius nodded and continued. "How did it happen?" I asked again. He replied dryly, "You fell, with a considerable portion of one of my trees, into one of my newly planted flower beds. I liked the man. He seemed to have a sense of humor. I felt sure that he at least was plumb straight." "Sure, Doc," I said, "I'm sorry about the tree, and I guess the new bulbs will be on me. But perhaps you'd like to know what I was doing in your garden." "I think the facts do call for an explanation," he replied. "Well, to begin with, I wasn't after the spoons." He smiled. "My first theory, but I soon altered my mind. By the way, you are an American, are you not?" I told him my name. "And you?" "I'm Dr. Hall, and this, as you doubtless know, is my private nursing home." I didn't know, but I wasn't going to put him wise. I was just thankful for the information. I liked the man, and I felt he was straight, but I wasn't going to give him the whole story. For one thing, he probably wouldn't have believed it. I made up my mind in a flash. "Why, Doctor," I said, "I guess I feel an almighty fool, but I owe it to you to let you know that it wasn't the Bill Sykes business I was up to." Then I went on and mumbled out something about a girl. I trotted out the stern guardian business and a nervous breakdown, and finally explained that I had fancied I recognized her among the patients at the home, hence my nocturnal adventures. I guess it was just the kind of story he was expecting. "Quite a romance," he said genially, when I'd finished. "Now, Doc," I went on, "will you be frank with me? Have you here now, or have you had here at any time, a young girl called Jane Finn?" He repeated the name thoughtfully. "Jane Finn," he said. "No." I was chagrined, and I guess I showed it. "You're sure?" "Quite sure, Mr. Hirschheimer. It is an uncommon name, and I should not have been likely to forget it." Well, that was flat. It laid me out for a space. I'd kind of hoped my search was at an end. "That's that," I said at last. "Now there's another matter. When I was hugging that darn branch, I thought I recognized an old friend of mine talking to one of your nurses. I purposely didn't mention any name, because, of course, Whittington might be calling himself something quite different down here. But the doctor answered at once, 'Mr. Whittington, perhaps?' 'That's the fella,' I replied. 'What's he doing down here? Don't tell me his nerves are out of order.' Dr. Hall laughed. 'No, he came down to see one of my nurses, Nurse Edith, who is a niece of his.' 'Why, fancy that,' I exclaimed. 'Is he still here?' 'No, he went back to town almost immediately.' 'What a pity,' I ejaculated. 'But perhaps I could speak to his niece, Nurse Edith, did you say her name was?' But the doctor shook his head. 'I'm afraid that, too, is impossible. Nurse Edith left with a patient tonight also.' 'I seem to be real unlucky,' I remarked. 'Have you Mr. Whittington's address in town? I guess I'd like to look him up when I get back.' 'I don't know his address. I can write to Nurse Edith for it, if you like.' I thanked him. 'Don't say who it is wants it. I'd like to give him a little surprise.' Well, that was about all I could do for the moment. Of course, if the girl was really Whittington's niece, she might be too cute to fall into the trap, but it was worth trying. Next thing I did was to write out a wire to Beresford, saying where I was, and that I was laid up with a sprained foot, and telling him to come down if he wasn't busy. I had to be guarded in what I said. However, I didn't hear from him, and my foot soon got all right. It was only ricked, not really sprained. So today I said goodbye to the little doctor chap, asked him to send me word if he heard from Nurse Edith, and came right away back to town. Say, Miss Tuppence, you're looking mighty pale.' 'It's Tommy,' said Tuppence. 'What can have happened to him?' 'Buck up. I guess he's all right, really. Why shouldn't he be? See here, it was a foreign-looking guy he went off after. Maybe they've gone abroad, to Poland or something like that.' Tuppence shook her head. 'He couldn't, without passports and things. Besides, I've seen that man, Boris something, since. He dined with Mrs. Vandermeer last night.' 'Mrs. who?' 'I forgot. Of course you don't know all that.' 'I'm listening,' said Julius, and gave vent to his favourite expression. 'Put me wise.' Tuppence thereupon related the events of the last 2 days. Julius's astonishment and admiration were unbounded. 'Bully for you! Fancy you a menial! It just tickles me to death.' Then he added seriously, 'But say now, I don't like it, Miss Tuppence, I sure don't. You're just as plucky as they make 'em, but I wish you'd keep right out of this. These crooks we're up against would as soon croak a girl as a man any day.'
'Do you think I'm afraid?' said Tuppence indignantly, valiantly repressing memories of the steely glitter in Mrs. Vandermeer's eyes.
'I said before you were darn plucky, but that doesn't alter facts.'
'Oh, bother me,' said Tuppence impatiently. 'Let's think about what can have happened to Tommy. I've written to Mr. Carter about it,' she added, and told him the gist of her letter.
Julius nodded gravely. 'I guess that's good, as far as it goes, but it's for us to get busy and do something.'
'What can we do?'
asked Tuppence, her spirits rising. 'I guess we'd better get on the track of Boris. You say he's been to your place? Is he likely to come again?'
He might. I really don't know.
I see. Well, I guess I'd better buy a car, a slap-up one, dress as a chauffeur, and hang about outside. Then if Boris comes, you could make some kind of signal, and I'd trail him. How's that?'
Splendid, but he mightn't come for weeks.
I'll have to chance that. I'm glad you like the plan.
He rose. Where are you going?
To buy the car, of course, replied Julius, surprised. What make you like? I guess you'll do some riding in it before we've finished.
Oh, said Tuppence faintly. I like Rolls-Royces, but...
Sure, agreed Julius. What you say goes, I'll get one.
But you can't at once, cried Tuppence. People wait ages sometimes.
Little Julius doesn't, affirmed Mr. Hirschheimer. Don't you worry any. I'll be round in the car in half an hour.
Tuppence got up. You're awfully good, Julius, but I can't help feeling that it's rather a forlorn hope. I'm really pinning my faith to Mr. Carter.
Then I shouldn't.
Why?
Just an idea of mine.
Oh, but he must do something. There's no one else. By the way, I forgot to tell you of a queer thing that happened this morning.
And she narrated her encounter with Sir James Peel Egerton. Julius was interested.
What did the guy mean, do you think?
He asked.
I don't quite know, said Tuppence meditatively. But I think that, in an ambiguous, legal, without prejudicious lawyer's way, he was trying to warn me.
Why should he?
I don't know, confessed Tuppence. But he looked kind and simply awfully clever. I wouldn't mind going to him and telling him everything.
Somewhat to her surprise, Julius negatived the idea sharply.
See here, he said, we don't want any lawyers mixed up in this. That guy couldn't help us any.
Well, I believe he could, reiterated Tuppence obstinately.
Don't you think it. So long, I'll be back in half an hour.
35 minutes had elapsed when Julius returned. He took Tuppence by the arm and walked her to the window.
There she is.
Oh, said Tuppence, with a note of reverence in her voice, as she gazed down at the enormous car.
She's some pacemaker, I can tell you, said Julius complacently.
How did you get it? Gasped Tuppence.
She was just being sent home to some bigwig.
Well?
I went round to his house, said Julius. I said that I reckoned a car like that was worth every penny of $20,000. Then I told him that it was worth just about $50,000 to me if he'd get out.
Well? Said Tuppence, intoxicated.
Well, returned Julius, he got out, that's all.
Chapter 12 A Friend in Need. Friday and Saturday passed uneventfully. Tuppence had received a brief answer to her appeal from Mr. Carter. In it he pointed out that the young adventurers had undertaken the work at their own risk and had been fully warned of the dangers. If anything had happened to Tommy, he regretted it deeply, but he could do nothing. This was cold comfort. Somehow, without Tommy, all the savour went out of the adventure, and for the first time Tuppence felt doubtful of success. While they had been together, she had never questioned it for a minute. Although she was accustomed to take the lead, and to pride herself on her quick-wittedness, in reality she had relied upon Tommy more than she realised at the time. There was something so eminently sober and clear-headed about him. His common sense and soundness of vision were so unvarying that without him Tuppence felt much like a rudderless ship. It was curious that Julius, who was undoubtedly much cleverer than Tommy, did not give her the same feeling of support. She had accused Tommy of being a pessimist, and it is certain that he always saw the disadvantages and difficulties which she herself was optimistically given to overlooking. But nevertheless, she had really relied a good deal on his judgment. He might be slow, but he was very sure. It seemed to the girl that, for the first time, she realized the sinister character of the mission they had undertaken so light-heartedly. It had begun like a page of romance. Now, shorn of its glamour, it seemed to be turning to grim reality. Tommy, that was all that mattered. Many times in the day Tuppence blinked the tears out of her eyes resolutely. "Little fool," she would apostrophize herself. "Don't snivel. Of course you're fond of him. You've known him all your life. But there's no need to be sentimental about it." In the meantime, nothing more was seen of Boris. He did not come to the flat, and Julius and the car waited in vain. Tuppence gave herself over to new meditations. Whilst admitting the truth of Julius's objections, she had nevertheless not entirely relinquished the idea of appealing to Sir James Peel Egerton. Indeed, she had gone so far as to look up his address in the Red Book. Had he meant to warn her that day? If so, why? Surely she was at least entitled to demand an explanation. He had looked at her so kindly. Perhaps he might tell them something concerning Mrs. Vandermeer, which might lead to a clue to Tommy's whereabouts. Anyway, Tuppence decided, with her usual shake of the shoulders, it was worth trying, and try it she would. Sunday was her afternoon out. She would meet Julius, persuade him to her point of view, and they would beard the lion in his den. When the day arrived, Julius needed a considerable amount of persuading, but Tuppence held firm. "It can do no harm," was what she always came back to. In the end, Julius gave in, and they proceeded in the car to Carlton House Terrace. The door was opened by an irreproachable butler. Tuppence felt a little nervous. After all, perhaps it was colossal cheek on her part. She had decided not to ask if Sir James was at home, but to adopt a more personal attitude. "Will you ask Sir James if I can see him for a few minutes? I have an important message for him." The butler retired, returning a moment or two later.
"Sir James will see you. Will you step this way?"
He ushered them into a room at the back of the house, furnished as a library. The collection of books was a magnificent one, and Tuppence noticed that all one wall was devoted to works on crime and criminology. There were several deep padded leather armchairs and an old-fashioned open hearth. In the window was a big roll-top desk, strewn with papers, at which the master of the house was sitting. He rose as they entered.
"You have a message for me?"
"Ah!" He recognised Tuppence with a smile.
"It's you, is it? Brought a message from Mrs. Vandermeer, I suppose."
"Not exactly," said Tuppence. "In fact, I'm afraid I only said that to be quite sure of getting in. Oh, by the way, this is Mr. Hirschheimer, Sir James Peel Egerton."
"Pleased to meet you," said the American, shooting out a hand. "Won't you both sit down?" asked Sir James.
He drew forward two chairs. "Sir James," said Tuppence, plunging boldly, "I dare say you will think it is most awful cheek of me coming here like this, because, of course, it's nothing whatever to do with you, and then you're a very important person, and, of course, Tommy and I are very unimportant." She paused for breath.
"Tommy?" queried Sir James, looking across at the American.
"No, that's Julius," explained Tuppence. "I'm rather nervous, and that makes me tell it badly. What I really want to know is what you meant by what you said to me the other day. Did you mean to warn me against Mrs. Vandermeer? You did, didn't you?"
"My dear young lady, as far as I recollect, I only mentioned that there were equally good situations to be obtained elsewhere."
"Yes, I know. But it was a hint, wasn't it?"
"Well, perhaps it was," admitted Sir James gravely.
"Well, I want to know more. I want to know just why you gave me a hint."
Sir James smiled at her earnestness. "Suppose the lady brings a libel action against me for defamation of character?"
"Of course," said Tuppence. "I know lawyers are always dreadfully careful, but can't we say without prejudice first, and then say just what we want to?"
"Well," said Sir James, still smiling. "Without prejudice, then. If I had a young sister forced to earn her living, I should not like to see her in Mrs. Vandermeer's service. I felt it incumbent on me just to give you a hint. It is no place for a young and inexperienced girl. That is all I can tell you."
"I see," said Tuppence thoughtfully. "Thank you very much. But I'm not really inexperienced, you know. I knew perfectly well that she was a bad lot when I went there. As a matter of fact, that's why I went—" She broke off, seeing some bewilderment on the lawyer's face, and went on, "I think perhaps I'd better tell you the whole story, Sir James. I've a sort of feeling that you'd know in a minute if I didn't tell the truth, so you might as well know all about it from the beginning. What do you think, Julius?"
"As you're bent on it, I'd go right ahead with the facts," replied the American,
who had so far sat in silence.
"Yes, tell me all about it," said Sir James. "I want to know who Tommy is."
Thus encouraged, Tuppence plunged into her tale, and the lawyer listened with close attention.
"Very interesting," he said when she finished. "A great deal of what you tell me, child, is already known to me. I've had certain theories of my own about this Jane Finn. You have done extraordinarily well so far, but it's rather too bad of, what do you know him as, Mr. Carter, to pitchfork you two young things into an affair of this kind.
By the way, where did Mr. Hirschheimer come in originally? You didn't make that clear." Julius answered for himself. "I'm Jane's first cousin," he explained, returning the lawyer's keen gaze.
"Ah!
Oh, Sir James," broke out Tuppence, "what do you think has become of Tommy?"
"Hmm."
The lawyer rose and paced slowly up and down.
"When you arrived, young lady, I was just packing up my traps, going to Scotland by the night train for a few days fishing. But there are different kinds of fishing. I've a good mind to stay and see if we can't get on the track of that young chap."
"Oh!" Tuppence clasped her hands ecstatically.
"All the same, as I said before, it's too bad of Carter to set you two babies on a job like this. Now don't get offended, Miss,
"Cowley, Prudence Cowley, but my friends call me Tuppence."
"Well, Miss Tuppence, then, as I'm certainly going to be a friend. Don't be offended because I think you're young. Youth is a failing only too easily outgrown. Now, about this young Tommy of yours."
"Yes?" Tuppence clasped her hands.
"Frankly, things look bad for him. He's been butting in somewhere where he wasn't wanted, not a doubt of it. But don't give up hope."
"And you really will help us? There, Julius, he didn't want me to come," she added, by way of explanation.
"Hmm," said the lawyer, favouring Julius with another keen glance. "And why was that?" "I reckoned it would be no good worrying you with a petty little business like this." "I see." He paused a moment. "This petty little business, as you call it, bears directly on a very big business, bigger, perhaps, than either you or Miss Tuppence know. If this boy is alive, he may have very valuable information to give us. Therefore we must find him."
"Yes, but how?" cried Tuppence. "I've tried to think of everything."
Sir James smiled. "And yet there's one person quite near at hand who in all probability knows where he is, or at all events where he is likely to be."
"Who is that?" asked Tuppence, puzzled.
"Mrs. Vandermeer."
"Yes, but she'd never tell us."
"Ah, that is where I come in. I think it quite likely that I shall be able to make Mrs. Vandermeer tell me what I want to know."
"How?"
demanded Tuppence, opening her eyes very wide. "Oh, just by asking her questions," replied Sir James easily. "That's the way we do it, you know."
He tapped with his finger on the table, and Tuppence felt again the intense power that radiated from the man.
"And if she won't tell?" asked Julius suddenly. "I think she will. I have one or two powerful levers. Still, in that unlikely event, there is always the possibility of bribery." "Sure, and that's where I come in," cried Julius, bringing his fist down on the table with a bang. "You can count on me, if necessary, for $1,000,000. Yes, sir, $1,000,000.
Sir James sat down and subjected Julius to a long scrutiny.
"Mr. Hirschheimer," he said at last, "that is a very large sum." "I guess it'll have to be. These aren't the kind of folk to offer sixpence to. At the present rate of exchange, it amounts to considerably over £250,000. "That's so. Maybe you think I'm talking through my hat, but I can deliver the goods all right, with enough over to spare for your fee."
Sir James flushed slightly.
"There is no question of a fee, Mr. Hirschheimer. I am not a private detective." "Sorry, I guess I was just a mite hasty, but I've been feeling bad about this money question. I wanted to offer a big reward for news of Jane some days ago, but your crusted institution of Scotland Yard advised me against it, said it was undesirable."
"They were probably right," said Sir James dryly.
"But it's all okay about Julius," put in Tuppence. "He's not pulling your leg. He's got simply pots of money."
"The old man piled it up in style," explained Julius. "Now let's get down to it. What's your idea?"
Sir James considered for a moment or two.
"There is no time to be lost. The sooner we strike, the better."
He turned to Tuppence.
"Is Mrs. Vandermeer dining out tonight, do you know?"
"Yes, I think so. But she will not be out late. Otherwise she would have taken the latch-key."
"Good. I will call upon her about 10 o'clock. What time are you supposed to return?"
"About 9:30 or 10. But I could go back earlier."
"You must not do that on any account. It might arouse suspicion if you did not stay out till the usual time. Be back by 9:30. I will arrive at 10. Mr. Hirschheimer will wait below in a taxi, perhaps."
"He's got a new Rolls-Royce car," said Tuppence, with vicarious pride.
"Even better. If I succeed in obtaining the address from her, we can go there at once, taking Mrs. Vandermeer with us, if necessary. You understand?"
"Yes!" Tuppence rose to her feet with a skip of delight. "Oh, I feel so much better!"
"'Don't build on it too much, Miss Tuppence. Go easy.'
Julius turned to the lawyer.
"'Say, then, I'll call for you in the car round about 9:30, is that right?' "'Perhaps that will be the best plan. It would be unnecessary to have two cars waiting about. "'Now, Miss Tuppence, my advice to you is to go and have a good dinner, a really good one, mind, and don't think ahead more than you can help.'
He shook hands with them both, and a moment later they were outside.
"'Isn't he a duck?' inquired Tuppence ecstatically as she skipped down the steps. "'Oh, Julius, isn't he just a duck?'
"'Well, I allow he seems to be the goods all right, and I was wrong about its being useless to go to him. Say, shall we go right away back to the Ritz?'
"'I must walk a bit, I think. I feel so excited. Drop me in the park, will you? Unless you'd like to come too?'
"'I want to get some petrol,' he explained, "'and send off a cable or two.
"'All right. I'll meet you at the Ritz at 7. "'You'll have to dine upstairs. "'I can't show myself in these glad rags.'
"'Sure. I'll get Felix to help me choose the menu. "'He's some head waiter, that. So long.'
Tuppence walked briskly along towards the Serpentine, first glancing at her watch. It was nearly 6 o'clock. She remembered that she had had no tea, but felt too excited to be conscious of hunger. She walked as far as Kensington Gardens, and then slowly retraced her steps, feeling infinitely better for the fresh air and exercise. It was not so easy to follow Sir James's advice and put the possible events of the evening out of her head. As she drew nearer and nearer to Hyde Park Corner, the temptation to return to South Audley Mansions was almost irresistible. At any rate, she decided it would do no harm just to go and look at the building. Perhaps then she could resign herself to waiting patiently for 10 o'clock. South Audley Mansions looked exactly the same as usual. What Tuppence had expected she hardly knew, but the sight of its red brick stolidity slightly assuaged the growing and entirely unreasonable uneasiness that possessed her. She was just turning away when she heard a piercing whistle, and the faithful Albert came running from the building to join her. Tuppence frowned. It was no part of the programme to have attention called to her presence in the neighbourhood, but Albert was purple with suppressed excitement.
"'I say, miss, she's a-going!'
"'Who's going?' demanded Tuppence sharply.
"'The crook, Reddy Rita, Mrs. Vandermeer. She's a-packing up, and she just sent down word for me to get her a taxi.'
"'What?'
Tuppence clutched his arm. "'It's the truth, miss. I thought maybe as you didn't know about it.' "'Albert!' cried Tuppence. "'You're a brick! If it hadn't been for you, we'd have lost her!'
Albert flushed with pleasure at this tribute.
"'There's no time to lose,' said Tuppence, crossing the road. "'I've got to stop her. At all costs, I must keep her here until—'
She broke off.
"'Albert, there's a telephone here, isn't there?'
The boy shook his head.
"'The flats mostly have their own, miss. But there's a box just round the corner.'
"'Go to it, then, at once, and ring up the Ritz Hotel—' "'Ask for Mr. Hirschheimer, and when you get him, tell him to get Sir James and come on at once, as Mrs. Vandermeer is trying to hook it. If you can't get him, ring up Sir James Peel Edgerton, you'll find his number in the book, and tell him what's happening. You won't forget the names, will you?'
Albert repeated them glibly.
"'You trust to me, miss, it'll be all right.
But what about you? Aren't you afraid to trust yourself with her? No, no, that's all right. But go and telephone. Be quick!'
Drawing a long breath, Tuppence entered the mansions and ran up to the door of number 20. How she was to detain Mrs. Vandermeer until the two men arrived she did not know, but somehow or other it had to be done, and she must accomplish the task single-handed. What had occasioned this precipitate departure? Did Mrs. Vandermeer suspect her? Speculations were idle. Tuppence pressed the bell firmly. She might learn something from the cook. Nothing happened. And after waiting some minutes, Tuppence pressed the bell again, keeping her finger on the button for some little while. At last she heard footsteps inside, and a moment later Mrs. Vandermeer herself opened the door. She lifted her eyebrows at the sight of the girl.
"'You?' "'I had a touch of toothache, ma'am,' said Tuppence glibly, "'so thought it better to come home and have a quiet evening.'
Mrs. Vandermeer said nothing, but she drew back and let Tuppence pass into the hall.
"'How unfortunate for you,' she said coldly. "'We'd better go to bed.'
"'Oh, I shall be all right in the kitchen, ma'am. Cook will—'
"'Cook is out,'
said Mrs. Vandermeer, in a rather disagreeable tone. "I sent her out. So you see you had better go to bed." Suddenly Tuppence felt afraid. There was a ring in Mrs. Vandermeer's voice that she did not like at all. Also, the other woman was slowly edging her up the passage. Tuppence turned at bay. "I don't want—" Then in a flash a rim of cold steel touched her temple, and Mrs. Vandermeer's voice rose, cold and menacing. "You damned little fool! Do you think I don't know? No, don't answer! If you struggle or cry out, I'll shoot you like a dog!" The rim of steel pressed a little harder against the girl's temple. "Now then, march!" went on Mrs. Vandermeer. "This way, into my room. In a minute, when I've done with you, you'll go to bed as I told you, and you'll sleep. Oh, yes, my little spy, you'll sleep all right." There was a sort of hideous geniality in the last words which Tuppence did not at all like. For the moment there was nothing to be done, and she walked obediently into Mrs. Vandermeer's bedroom. The pistol never left her forehead. The room was in a state of wild disorder. Clothes were flung about, right and left. A suitcase and a hat-box, half-packed, stood in the middle of the floor. Tuppence pulled herself together with an effort. Her voice shook a little, but she spoke out bravely. "Come now," she said, "this is nonsense. You can't shoot me. Why, everyone in the building would hear the report." "I'd risk that," said Mrs. Vandermeer cheerfully. "But as long as you don't sing out for help, you're all right, and I don't think you will. You're a clever girl. You deceived me all right. I hadn't a suspicion of you. So I've no doubt that you understand perfectly well that this is where I'm on top and you're underneath. Now then, sit on the bed. Put your hands above your head, and if you value your life, don't move them." Tuppence obeyed passively. Her good sense told her that there was nothing else to do but accept the situation. If she shrieked for help, there was very little chance of anyone hearing her, whereas there was probably quite a good chance of Mrs. Vandermeer shooting her. In the meantime, every minute of delay gained was valuable. Mrs. Vandermeer laid down the revolver on the edge of the washstand within reach of her hand, and still eyeing Tuppence like a lynx in case the girl should attempt to move, she took a little stoppered bottle from its place on the marble and poured some of its contents into a glass, which she filled up with water. "What's that?" asked Tuppence sharply. "Something to make you sleep soundly." Tuppence paled a little. "Are you going to poison me?" she asked in a whisper. "Perhaps," said Mrs. Vandermeer, smiling agreeably. "Then I shan't drink it," said Tuppence firmly. "I'd much rather be shot. At any rate, that would make a row, and someone might hear it. But I won't be killed off quietly like a lamb." Mrs. Vandermeer stamped her foot. "Don't be a little fool. Do you really think I want to hue and cry for murder out after me? If you've any sense at all, you'd realize that poisoning you wouldn't suit my book at all. It's a sleeping draught, that's all. Wake up tomorrow morning, none the worse. I simply don't want the bother of tying you up and gagging you. That's the alternative, and you won't like it, I can tell you. I can be very rough if I choose. So drink this down like a good girl, and you'll be none the worse for it." In her heart of hearts, Tuppence believed her. The argument she had adduced rang true. It was a simple and effective method of getting her out of the way for the time being. Nevertheless, the girl did not take kindly to the idea of being tamely put to sleep without as much as one bid for freedom. She felt that once Mrs. Vandermeer gave them the slip, the last hope of finding Tommy would be gone. Tuppence was quick in her mental processes. All these reflections passed through her mind in a flash, and she saw where a chance, a very problematical chance, lay, and she determined to risk all in one supreme effort. Accordingly, she lurched suddenly off the bed and fell on her knees before Mrs. Vandermeer, clutching her skirts frantically. "I don't believe it!" she moaned. "It's poison! I know it's poison! Oh, don't make me drink it!" Her voice rose to a shriek. "Don't make me drink it!" Mrs. Vandermeer, glass in hand, looked down with a curling lip at this sudden collapse. "Get up, you little idiot! Don't go on drivelling there! How you ever had the nerve to play your part as you did, I can't think!" She stamped her foot. "Get up, I say!" But Tuppence continued to cling and sob, interjecting her sobs with incoherent appeals for mercy. Every minute gained was to the good.
Moreover, as she grovelled, she moved imperceptibly nearer to her objective. Mrs. Vandermeer gave a sharp, impatient exclamation and jerked the girl to her knees. "Drink it at once!" Imperiously, she pressed the glass to the girl's lips. Tuppence gave one last despairing moan.
"Ah, you swear it won't hurt me?" she temporised.
"Of course it won't hurt you. Don't be a fool."
"Will you swear it?"
"Yes, yes," said the other impatiently. "I swear it." Tuppence raised a trembling left hand to the glass.
"Very well."
Her mouth opened meekly. Mrs. Vandermeer gave a sigh of relief, off her guard for the moment. Then, quick as a flash, Tuppence jerked the glass upward as hard as she could. The fluid in it splashed into Mrs. Vandermeer's face, and during her momentary gasp, Tuppence's right hand shot out and grasped the revolver where it lay on the edge of the washstand. The next moment she had sprung back a pace, and the revolver pointed straight at Mrs. Vandermeer's heart with no unsteadiness in the hand that held it. In the moment of victory, Tuppence betrayed a somewhat unsportsmanlike triumph.
"Now who's on top and who's underneath?" she crowed.
The other's face was convulsed with rage. For a minute, Tuppence thought she was going to spring upon her, which would have placed the girl in an unpleasant dilemma, since she meant to draw the line at actually letting off the revolver. However, with an effort, Mrs. Vandermeer controlled herself, and at last a slow, evil smile crept over her face.
"Not a fool, then, after all. You did that well, girl. But you shall pay for it. Oh, yes, you shall pay for it. I have a long memory."
"I'm surprised you should have been gulled so easily," said Tuppence scornfully. "Did you really think I was the kind of girl to roll about on the floor and whine for mercy?"
"You may do, some day," said the other significantly.
The cold malignity of her manner sent an unpleasant chill down Tuppence's spine, but she was not going to give in to it.
"Supposing we sit down," she said pleasantly. "Our present attitude is a little melodramatic. No, not on the bed. Draw a chair up to the table, that's right. Now, I'll sit opposite you with the revolver in front of me, just in case of accidents."
"Splendid.
Now, let's talk."
"What about?" said Mrs. Vandermeer sullenly. Tuppence eyed her thoughtfully for a minute. She was remembering several things. Boris's words, "I believe you would sell us," and her answer, "The price would have to be enormous." Given lightly, it was true, yet might there not be a substratum of truth in it? Long ago, had not Whittington asked, "Who's been blabbing, Rita?" Would Rita Vandermeer prove to be the weak spot in the armour of Mr. Brown? Keeping her eyes fixed steadily on the other's face, Tuppence replied quietly, "Money." Mrs. Vandermeer started. Clearly the reply was unexpected.
"What do you mean?"
"I'll tell you. You said just now that you had a long memory. A long memory isn't half as useful as a long purse. I dare say it relieves your feelings a good deal to plan out all sorts of dreadful things to do to me. But is that practical? Revenge is very unsatisfactory. Everyone always says so. But money?" Tuppence warmed to her pet creed. "Well, there's nothing unsatisfactory about money, is there?"
"Do you think," said Mrs. Vandermeer scornfully, "that I'm the kind of woman to sell my friends?"
"Yes," said Tuppence promptly, "if the price was big enough.
A paltry 100 pounds or so."
"No," said Tuppence, "I should suggest 100,000. Her economical spirit did not permit her to mention the whole $1 million suggested by Julius. A flush crept over Mrs. Vandermeer's face.
"What did you say?" she asked,
her fingers playing nervously with a brooch on her breast. In that moment Tuppence knew that the fish was hooked, and for the first time she felt a horror of her own money-loving spirit. It gave her a dreadful sense of kinship to the woman fronting her.
£100,000, repeated Tuppence.
The light died out of Mrs. Vandermeer's eyes. She leaned back in her chair.
"Pah," she said, "you haven't got it."
"No," admitted Tuppence, "I haven't. But I know someone who has."
"Who?"
"A friend of mine." must be a millionaire," remarked Mrs. Vandermeer unbelievingly. "As a matter of fact, he is. He's an American. He'll pay you that without a murmur. You can take it from me that it's a perfectly genuine proposition."
Mrs. Vandermeer sat up again.
"I'm inclined to believe you," she said slowly.
There was silence between them for some time. Then Mrs. Vandermeer looked up.
"What does he want to know, this friend of yours?"
Tuppence went through a momentary struggle, but it was Julius's money, and his interests must come first.
"He wants to know where Jane Finn is," she said boldly.
Mrs. Vandermeer showed no surprise.
"I'm not sure where she is at the present moment," she replied. "But you could find out?" "Oh, yes," returned Mrs. Vandermeer carelessly. "There would be no difficulty about that."
"Then," Tuppence's voice shook a little,
"there's a boy, a friend of mine. I'm afraid something's happened to him through your pal Boris."
"What's his name?"
"Tommy Beresford." "Never heard of him. But I'll ask Boris. He'll tell me anything he knows." "Thank you."
Tuppence felt a terrific rise in her spirits. It impelled her to more audacious efforts.
"There's one thing more."
"Well?" Tuppence leaned forward and lowered her voice.
"Who is Mr. Brown?"
Her quick eyes saw the sudden paling of the beautiful face. With an effort, Mrs. Vandermeer pulled herself together and tried to resume her former manner, but the attempt was a mere parody. She shrugged her shoulders.
"You can't have learned much about us if you don't know that nobody knows who Mr. Brown is."
"You do," said Tuppence quietly. Again the colour deserted the other's face.
"What makes you think that?"
"I don't know," said the girl truthfully, "but I'm sure." Mrs. Vandermeer stared in front of her for a long time.
"Yes," she said hoarsely, at last. "I know. I was beautiful, you see. Very beautiful."
"You are still," said Tuppence, with admiration. Mrs. Vandermeer shook her head. There was a strange gleam in her electric blue eyes.
"Not beautiful enough," she said in a soft, dangerous voice. "Not beautiful enough. And sometimes, lately, I've been afraid... It's dangerous to know too much."
She leaned forward across the table.
"Swear that my name shan't be brought into it, that no one shall ever know?"
"I swear it. And once he's caught, you'll be out of danger." A terrified look swept across Mrs. Vandermeer's face.
"Shall I? Shall I ever be?"
She clutched Tuppence's arm.
"You're sure about the money?"
"Quite sure."
"When shall I have it? There must be no delay." "This friend of mine will be here presently. He may have to send cables or something like that, but there won't be any delay. He's a terrific hustler."
A resolute look settled on Mrs. Vandermeer's face.
"I'll do it. It's a great sum of money. Besides," she gave a curious smile, "it is not wise to throw over a woman like me."
For a moment or two she remained, smiling and lightly tapping her fingers on the table. Suddenly she started and her face blanched.
"What was that?"
"I heard nothing." Mrs. Vandermeer gazed round her fearfully.
"If there should be someone listening?"
"Nonsense! Who could there be?"
"Even the walls might have ears," whispered the other. "I tell you I'm frightened. You don't know him."
"Think of the 100,000 pounds," said Tuppence soothingly. Mrs. Vandermeer passed her tongue over her dried lips.
"You don't know him," she reiterated hoarsely. "He's... Ah!"
With a shriek of terror, she sprang to her feet. Her outstretched hand pointed over Tuppence's head, then she swayed to the ground in a dead faint. Tuppence looked round to see what had startled her. In the doorway were Sir James Peel Edgerton and Julius Hirschheimer.